Good morning. We gather in this place, made holy by the lives within it. May we find here our sorrows lightened, our joys strengthened, our spirits lifted by this beloved community. Welcome to Unitarian Universalists of San Mateo. My name is Christy Conklin. I've been a member here for 9 years. I am honored to be your worship associate today and delighted that you're all with us this morning. There are many activities in our order of service. Please make a note to read them all. And there are a few that I want to call out especially. Today is Social Justice Sunday, so there is a letter to sign in the Beck Hall after the service. And they're also looking for Home and Hope volunteers starting next Sunday. And you can sign up online. The address is in the order of service. And Tom, our worship leader this morning, Tom Newman, has asked me to give a special thank you, 1 week late, to the Fixer Upper volunteers who made the place all spiffy for the coming year. Isabel and John Bertolet, Diana Candee, Margaret and Peter Cross, Dick Davis, Michael Duncan, Homer Eaton, Gail Ewing, Becky Howland, Tom McCune, Phyllis Mitchell, Truman Smith, and Gretchen Warner. So thanks to them all. On this table in the corner, we have a book in which you're invited to write your joys and concerns and to bring attention to our pastoral staff and the congregation. If you'd like them to be private, then please indicate that, and we will share those joys and concerns as indicated. If this is your first time here, or if you're returning after a long absence, and only if you would like to do so, we ask you now to stand and tell us your name and where you're from. Any visitors? Hello. Welcome. Okay, well, welcome. We are a welcoming congregation, which means that whoever you are and however you came to be here, we're glad you're with us today. We hope that you may find a spiritual home among us. Please join us for coffee hour after the service. And there will be a polka-dotted mug there for you to take so that we can greet you. At this time, we light the chalice. One chalice for our community, which holds our history, our search for truth and meaning, our commitment to work for peace and justice, and our covenant with one another. We light the second chalice for our partner church in the Philippines. Now please recite with me our mission statement as it's printed in the order of service.
We are a religious community of open hearts and open minds, working together to transform ourselves and the world.
Our opening words this morning are from Joy Atkinson, The Womb of Stars. The womb of stars embraces us. Remnants of their fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are of the stars, the dust of explosions cast across space. We are of the earth. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and beasts. Their cells nourish the soil. We build our communities on their harvest of gifts. Our fingers trace the curves carved in clay and stone by forebears unknown to us. We are a part of the great circle of humanity, gathered around the fire, the hearth, the altar. We gather anew this day to celebrate our common heritage. May we recall in gratitude all that has given us birth.
Come, come, whoever you are.
Wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come. words adapted from Rumi. Let's rise together in body or spirit. Words are in your hymnal at 188. I would invite you to open that if you wish. If you know it already, it's right here, right close to your lips and your heart. We're going to sing it once through all together, and then we'll do it around twice. And so this side on the round will be led by Tish, and I'll lead this side of the round. Come, come.
Come, come, whoever you are, Father, worship, Father of being, because it's no better than of despair. Come, give it, come. Come, come, whoever you are, come, come, whoever you are, Father, worship, Father of being, because
for all ages this morning is the story called Starfish on the Beach, which I'm betting has been told here sometimes before. I wonder if any of these kids already know this story. I thought you might. So don't tell what the last line that the little girl says, but then at the end, if you want to say it, then I'll let you do that, okay? So it's called Starfish on the Beach, and it's by Tom and Lindy Schneider, but the story is kind of familiar. So it says, one afternoon on a sparkling sandy beach, a mother and her daughter were picking up seashells. The tide was out, so they found many treasures. Mama, put this in your bag, please, said the little girl as she held up a pretty pink striped shell. Mama carried a bag for collecting such things. Mom and Sandy walked along the shoreline, making footprints side by side. Suddenly, Sandy stopped. She saw something that was bigger than a seashell. Hold this up here for you to see it too. Sandy ran ahead for a closer look. Look, Mama said, Sandy, there are stars on the beach. Mama looked too. You found some starfish. They usually hide in the cool water. Poor starfish, said Sandy. The sun is cooking them. The tide will come back in soon and they will be all right, said Mama. Little Sandy was not so sure. Without a word, she picked up one crusty starfish after another and tossed them into the refreshing water. Mama watched for a while. You can't save them all, she said. I know, said Sandy, and she picked up two more starfish and tossed them into the water. The shore stretched on forever, and the starfish polka-dotted the beach as far as they could see. Mama, could you help me? Asked Sandy. So Mama helped rescue the starfish until a wave of sadness swept over her heart. There are so many starfish that need help, said Mama. I don't think we're making much of a difference here. Little Sandy thought for a moment and then picked up one more starfish and tossed it into the rolling waves. She smiled as she ran back to Mama.
Made a difference.
What did she say?
Made a difference to that one.
I made a difference to that one, she said. Mama smiled and said, yes, you did. And why I picked out this story, when I was preparing the service with Christy, I was actually feeling kind of sad, and Christy said, well, you should look at the sermons and the presentations by Reverend Michael Dowd and his wife Connie Barlow, whom I remembered because they had come here, and I actually liked them so much I got their the video of their lectures, and I watched that. And one of the stories that Connie Barlow told was about a kind of pine tree called Torreya taxifolia. And Torreya taxifolia is endangered. Does anyone know what that means? An endangered species? What does that mean?
That means is soon to go extinct if we don't.
It might go extinct, and then there won't be any more of this particular kind of of pine tree called Torreya taxifolia. And so there's this group called the Torreya Guardians, who are taking seeds and seedlings from Torreya taxifolia and transplanting them, working with biologists trying to figure out where they could grow and transplanting them so that one species won't go extinct. I thought that's kind of reminded me of the story of starfish on the beach and made me feel a little better. So that's our story.
We have a song, Turn the World Around, that talks about all those things, where we come from and where we're going and also that we are part of this big web of life, aren't we? So let's all stand up together with me. We're going to sing a little bit of it, and then after we sing it all the way through kind of once, then Nancy's going to meet you over here and walk that way and take you to your time together if you wish to go. So here we go. We come from the fire. I like to turn around when we sing Turn the World Around.
We come from the fire.
Oh,
I'll do this part. We will now take the offering. Yes, the offering will now be taken.
That's
oh, is there?
That's here. Yeah.
Sorry. Ah! No. We have the opportunity to participate in the work of our beloved community by sharing our resources. A gift in the collection plate fosters a spirit of generosity and abundance in our lives, and it helps further our mission in the world and maintains the programs of this congregation. So please contribute as you are able. Now the offering will be taken.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for these gifts for our community. They are received with great gratitude. Thank you.
Our first reading is Wild Geese by Mary Oliver, a poem we, many of us know and love. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
Thank you.
should I live my life? My one wild and precious life, when it's so hard just to get dinner on the table every night? I have a three-part answer I'd like to share with you. Number one, live in geologic time. Geologic time is the clock by which continents move and meld, by which oceans and islands form. It is measured in millions of years and eons of ecological change, with no reference to the existence of human life or life at all. As Thomas Berry said, the Earth is primary. Humans are derivative. We just don't matter very much to Mother Earth, who will keep doing what she does, building mountains, churning oceans, supporting life, forever and ever. Amen. Keeping this fact at the front of my mind makes me a lot less anxious about the evening news, which is always spouting imminent doom. If I remember that I am inconsequentially tiny, as is my species and even the eon I'm living in, I can find much greater peace of mind. So consider the context in which you frame your life and see if making that as big as possible helps you ask and answer the most important question. For me, finding this context made it possible for me to get to number two. Number two, permission to prioritize joy. The people I admire most and aspire to be like are the most joyful. Not the most intelligent or the most accomplished, the most joyful. And because I try to stay aware of this bigger timescale, I've let myself stop feeling so responsible for personally solving every trouble in the world. For me, the burden of saving the world had meant that I had no time left to savor it, and it made me unhappy. So I simply released myself from that responsibility, which has given me some free time, made a little space for joy. This means I don't do as much social justice work as I used to do, because it honestly didn't bring me genuine joy. But there are many people for whom it does. And part of the permission to prioritize joy is trusting that when we're all living in a place of genuine fulfillment, all the good work will get done. And it will be done in love and joy, not out of fear or obligation or guilt. For me, joy is found in nature and in art and in close relationships with a few people. So what brings you joy? Make a list and post it on your fridge, because it's easy to forget the important things when the laundry is piling up. And then do more of that thing, those things, every single day until you die. Because that is your true purpose. And by doing more of that, you will be living the richest life you can and offering your best gifts to the world. Which brings me to my third point. Number three, true joy is just. The Dalai Lama says that to experience true joy, you have to fully understand the interconnected nature of existence. I cannot gain if you lose. My joy cannot come at the expense of others or the planet. In this way, joy is not the same as fun, because joy is developed in the context of our values. Better yet, says His Holiness, is to generate your own happiness in the act of serving others in the world. This kind of genuine joy leads to a more just world so that we are not forced to choose between saving the world and savoring it. They become the same thing. I would additionally suggest that maybe it's only the work done from this place of genuine joy that can serve and transform the world by seeding it with positive, dynamic energy that's inspiring and infectious to others. So slow down, find the stillness where you can, and joy will emerge. And then go out and do more of that thing. Do lots and lots of that thing until your very last day on this wild and precious earth.
Let us now turn our hearts towards one another and the depths of our personal and collective spiritual lives. Settle into the stillness of this moment. Close your eyes, relax, breathe deeply. Feel your breath and the breath of those around you. Feel your body in this place and those around you sharing this space. Feel your feet connected to the earth and to all those who share and treasure it. Be in harmony with one another for this moment. Connect again with that larger love that holds us all. Be still.
Our second reading is a poem by Richard Gilbert titled, To Savor the World or to Save It. I arise in the morning, torn between the desire to save the world and to savor it, to serve life or to enjoy it, to savor the world or save it. The question beats in upon the waiting moment, to savor the sweet taste of my own joy or to share the bitter cup of my neighbor, to celebrate life with exuberant step or to struggle for the life of the heavy laden. What am I to do when the guilt at my bounty clouds the sky of my vision, when the glow which lights my every day illumines the hurting world around me? To savor the world or save it? God of justice, if such there be, take from me the burden of my question. Let me praise my plenitude without limit. Let me cast my eyes from all troubled folk. No. You will not let me be. You will not stop my ears to the cries of the hurt and the hungry. You will not close my eyes to the sight of the afflicted. No, you will not. What's that you say? To savor, one must serve. To savor, one must save. The one will not stand without the other. Forgive me. In my preoccupation with self, in my concern for my own life, I had forgotten. Forgive me, God of justice, forgive me, and make me whole.
Number 146 in the gray scene of the living tradition hymnal.
Nice to be back for what will be my seventh sermon here. If you're thinking it seems like I was just up here preaching on healing the world and ourselves, it seems like that to me too. But that was a year ago. And though I did not volunteer again for this so soon, I did say yes when asked because I wanted the opportunity to continue to sort out some important questions for myself. In fact, I've immodestly titled this service The Most Important Question. And that is the question posed at the top of your order of service and that Christy has already addressed. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? The poem Christy read by Richard Gilbert, To Savor the World or Save It, refers to a famous quote by E.B. White, which goes, "If the world were merely seductive, that would be easy.
If it were merely challenging, that would be no problem. But I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. This makes it difficult to plan the day. That has been one of my favorite quotes for a long time, capturing a central dilemma that many of us struggle with. But reflecting on it now at age 58, I wonder that I had never noticed the third possibility that had been left out, one I seem to find increasingly appealing as I get older. As one of my all-time heroes, Pete Seeger, put it in his song, "My Get Up and Go Has Got Up and Went," I get up each morning and dust off my wits, open the paper and read the obits. If I'm not there, I know I'm not dead, so I eat a good breakfast and go back to bed. So going back to or staying in bed is another option for E.B. White and all of us. Indeed, I have to admit that I enjoy napping more than ever as I get older. It's one of my guilty pleasures. It's one of my favorite activities on weekends and vacations. I did a report on Ben Franklin in high school, though, and one of his sayings was, "Up, sluggard, and waste not life. In the grave we'll be sleeping enough." And sometimes I hear Franklin admonishing me when I am lingering too long in bed. But on the other hand, I'm sure when I'm dead, I won't enjoy sleeping nearly as much as I do now. So maybe we can put sleeping in the savor life category, since it can be enjoyable. And as all the new parents and insomniacs out there will attest, its lack can be miserable. I'll also point out that compared with many other ways to savor life, it is inexpensive and has a very low carbon footprint. And it's great to do with someone you love. But of course, if you had all stayed in bed, you wouldn't be here. Thank you for coming. I hope I can keep you awake, and that if I can't, you savor your nap. Before we leave the topic of sleep, I do want to point out that I have found that some of the things I am most proud of accomplishing were things that I did when I was very tired. There's something about pushing ourselves to the limit for something we believe in, whether it is caring for a sick child or finishing a sermon or a grant, that at least for me provides an extra level of satisfaction. A related observation is the irony that even as I continue to seek out such experiences, when I am in the midst of doing some of the things I find most fulfilling, I can't wait for them to be over. I love taking care of newborns, but as soon as I start one of my weeks attending in the nursery, I begin counting the days until it will be over. I guess the key is having an end date. What about the awake time? What about the save or savor the world dilemma? In the save the world category, for some reason, I have been drawn to very large and rather abstract issues. As many of you know, I've been active in Physicians for Social Responsibility for many years. PSR's mission is to educate the public about catastrophic threats to human survival. For many years, that meant nuclear weapons, and in fact, nuclear weapons have been a major concern of mine since I learned what they were and what they could do. They were the topic of my third and arguably most depressing sermon here in honor of Hiroshima Day in 2005. But in the last 10 years or so, PSR has focused on global climate change, the topic of my sermon here last year. A few months ago, one of my PSR colleagues forwarded a less than cheery 2013 article by Paul and Ann Ehrlich from the biology department down the road at Stanford titled, "Can a Collapse of Global Civilization Be Avoided?" The short answer is maybe, but it doesn't look good. The Ehrlich cite ecological footprint analyses that show that to sustainably support today's population as we currently live would require 1.5 planets Earth. And if all 7 billion people consumed resources at the US level, it would require 5 or 6 Earths. Add to this the fact that the population is projected to increase by another 2.5 billion by 2050, even as key aquifers run dry, and global climate change threatens to dry out or inundate much of the rest of the planet. And as the saying goes, Houston and the rest of the Earth, we have a problem. The Ehrlichs also cite the work of Jared Diamond on the collapse of societies. I feel a special connection to Jared because I knew his father, who was a pediatric hematologist who worked at UCSF at the end of his career. Anyway, Diamond uses a 5-point framework to understand the collapse of civilizations. 1, environmental degradation. 2, climate change. 3 and 4 are relations with friendly and unfriendly neighbors. And 5 is how society responds, especially whether leadership elites face conflicts between their own short-term interests and the changes needed for their society to survive. The Ehrlichs point out that current environmental threats are global in nature, threatening the whole planet rather than individual societies. So in fact, there are no neighbors, friendly or unfriendly, who might change our fate. We are it. And unfortunately, our leadership elites seem unwilling or unable to deal with this problem. In his TED talk on the topic, Diamond draws an analogy between people on Earth and bacteria on a culture plate. The population of bacteria doubles every 30 minutes or so for multiple generations until slightly more than half the space on the culture plate or the available nutrients have been used up. Then one more generation and the capacity of the plate is exceeded and boom, they all die. That's the thing about exponential growth. That very last doubling adds as many as all previous doublings combined. So in short, we have a perfect storm of overpopulation, environmental degradation, and dominant power elites whose short-term interests service our overconsumption of natural resources. And let's not forget the thousands of nuclear weapons available to throw into the mix when things get unstable or desperate. It reminded me of a quote from Woody Allen that I almost included as one of the readings. "More than any time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to utter hopelessness and despair, the other to total extinction. Let us hope we have the wisdom to choose correctly." So what do we do? Without in any way deprecating or dismissing the concrete actions each of us can and should take to reduce our environmental footprint and steer our country and the world to a more sustainable future, I feel like it is important for me to acknowledge the real possibility, if not overwhelming likelihood, that we have passed the so-called tipping point and that some very tough times are ahead no matter what we do. I see an analogy with how we all must come to terms with our own deaths. We become very attached to this life, but much as we might wish it otherwise, we know that it is going to end. Quoting Woody Allen again, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality by not dying." Unfortunately, that is not a choice we have. In some circles, it is taboo to talk about death. It is something none of us much wants to think about. Indeed, in some cultures, people will hide or refuse to talk about a terminal illness with someone who is dying. But I don't favor that approach. I think it deprives the dying person of the ability to share fears and connect with loved ones when the need for those connections is the greatest. And I think a beloved community like this one is one in which we need to be able to face and share our deepest fears and how we are trying to deal with them, because a sorrow shared is a sorrow diminished. So that's what I'm doing now. And I hope it works and it's okay with you. I found comfort in the existentialist view that although there is a great deal over which we have no control, we can control what sort of person we choose to be and how we choose to respond to the absurd and sometimes awful catastrophes that come our way. Yes, we may be aboard the Titanic, but we can still choose to play our violins at the end. I've also found comfort, as Christy has, in trying to acknowledge and fully accept our insignificance in the vastness of space-time. I want to thank Diana Chung for suggesting this perspective when we had our workshop on climate change with Reverend Earl Cotine last year. Our little planet orbits a sun that is one of about 200 billion stars in the Milky Way, which is one of about 200 billion galaxies in the universe. How many is 200 billion? It's a hard number to grasp. If we take 200 billion times the width of a human hair, about a tenth of a millimeter, that would be the distance from here to Madagascar, which it turns out is about as far as you can get from San Mateo on planet Earth. And even if we do everything right, and we and our descendants all got to live out to be 100 years old, we'd still only get to experience one 140 millionth of time so far. You've probably heard these analogies before. If all of time were compressed into a single year and the Big Bang happened at midnight on January 1st, then the sun and the planets didn't form until August, multicellular organisms until November, and the first vertebrates and land plants arrived in mid-December. Modern humans would arrive 6 minutes before midnight, writing would be developed at 15 seconds before midnight, and my own little slice of time amounts to about a tenth of a second of that year. Blink and it's over. I recently finished a great book about science called A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson. This may seem strange, but besides the comfort from our relative insignificance, I found the various possible doomsday scenarios that have nothing to do with human activity strangely comforting as well. We are currently in the midst of the Earth's sixth great extinction period. Although this one is largely being triggered by human activity, the fact that it is the sixth means that great extinctions have happened five times before when it wasn't our fault. The last one led to the extinction of the dinosaurs, and it appears to have been triggered by the KT meteor, which struck Earth with the force of 100 million megatons. As Bryson writes, such an outburst is not easily imagined, but as James Lawrence Powell has pointed out, if you exploded a Hiroshima-sized bomb for every person alive on Earth today, you would still be about a billion bombs short of the KP impact. Bryson has a nice way of helping us think about the danger of meteors. Quote, "Think of the Earth's orbit as a kind of freeway on which we are the only vehicle, but which is crossed regularly by pedestrians who don't know enough to look before stepping off the curb. At least 90% of these pedestrians are quite unknown to us. We don't know where they live, what sort of hours they keep, how often they come our way. All we know is that at some point, at uncertain intervals, they trundle across the road down which we are cruising at 66,000 miles an hour. Although it was thought that some 2,000 asteroids big enough to imperil civilized existence regularly, it's thought that 2,000 asteroids big enough to imperil civilized existence regularly cross our orbit. But even a small asteroid, the size of a house or so, could destroy a city. The number of these relative tiddlers in Earth-crossing orbit is almost certainly in the hundreds of thousands and possibly in the millions, and they are nearly impossible to track. The first one wasn't spotted until 1991, and that was after it had already gone by." You get the picture. Closer to home, Bryson writes about the ticking time bomb that happens to be one of my favorite places on the planet, Yellowstone National Park. Quote, "The Yellowstone eruption of 2 million years ago put out enough ash to bury New York State to a depth of 67 feet, or California to a depth of 20. All of this was hypothetically interesting until 1973, when geologists did a survey and discovered that a large area of the park had developed an ominous bulge. The geologists realized that only one thing could cause this, a restless magma chamber. Yellowstone wasn't the site of an ancient supervolcano, it was the site of an active one. It was also about this time that they were able to work out the cycle of Yellowstone's eruptions, which average one massive blow every 600,000 years. The last one, interestingly enough, was 630,000 years ago. Yellowstone, it appears, is due. So to summarize, as Bryson puts it, only one thing is certain. We live on a knife edge. Sooner or later, and it might be very soon, not only will we all die, but pretty much everything we hold precious might be gone, possibly forever or possibly just for a few thousand or million years. How does this help us with the question I posed at the beginning about how we should spend our time? Well, first, I'm once again taking to heart the quote I first heard here from Jerry Motto that I repeated in my last sermon. Please do not feel personally, totally, irrevocably responsible for everything. That's my job. Love God. We have all the more reason to savor the world because no matter what we do, not only we, but also it may not be around much longer. Just as our own mortality should make us savor our lives more, so the vulnerability and finite lifespan of civilization and the earth as we know it should make us savor those all the more. What about the saving? I was eating lunch last year with my friend Steve, and he said something like, "Tom, you've done 100 times what I have to try to rid the world of nuclear weapons, but what have you actually accomplished?" And I'm glad to have a relationship with Steve that he felt comfortable asking me that question, because it's a good one. And my answer is that I don't have illusions about accomplishing much or saving the world. There's an awful lot over which I have no control. But one thing I do have control over is what sort of person I choose to be. And for now, I choose to be a person who tries to raise awareness and do something about problems that seem important, while at the same time fully aware of the limitations of my contributions. Along those same lines, I harbor no illusions about the impact of my various lifestyle choices, from avoiding meat and airplane travel to driving a Leaf, on the health and well-being of the planet or its other species. The effects are most likely immeasurably trivial. So it's really more about who I choose to be and what feels to me the right way to live than it is about saving the world. In a way, the save-saver distinction is artificial anyway, though, as Richard Gilbert and Christie have suggested. Part of how I savor the world is by feeling connection to it, and part of how I feel connection is living in a way that reflects that connection. So at least for now, I'll keep giving climate lectures, riding my bicycle and eating the lentils, joyfully tossing my few little starfish back into the water, because that's partly how I choose to savor the world. Even the lentils. Johanna makes great lentils. And who knows, maybe I will make more of a difference than I know. So on a positive note, I'll close with a quote from Robert Kennedy that I shared at Kay McCann's memorial service. "Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events, and in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance." May it be so, and in the meantime, we can sing and comfort each other.
Comfort me, O my soul. Words are hearing thee, food and search.
Thank you.
please join me in reading the words by Elizabeth Sally Jones that are printed in your order of service. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we other again. You are now invited to stand as you are able and turn toward the center aisle and join hands across the pews. Our closing words are by Adrian Rich. My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed, I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. Go out with joy and gratitude. Thank you.